Hey Zach, how you doing?
Hey Ken, I can't answer that. How are you?
I'm great. I'm recovering from the effects of a parasite that's wreaked havoc on me for the last week. And that's as much detail as I'm going to give.
Yeah, because just before we started recording, you gave me very intimate details,
Well,
some of which involving a stick.
yeah, it wasn't a good thing. I don't recommend it.
No, that's an
So.
experience I will do without. But anyways, I'm glad you're better, Ken, because now we can sit here and we can talk about whatever today's topic is. I am actually looking at it right now, but I'd prefer if you said it.
It's because of my sultry voice.
Oh yeah, that's why you do all the talking. It's
Here,
because your sweet and sultry voice.
let me try to put something. Let's put a spin on encryption. That sound nice?
Ooh. Ooh, that sounded very nice. Even over Skype, that sounded great.
Encryption. Okay, so before we get there, this is episode 4. I think that's awesome. That's not a prime number. This is our first episode that is not a prime number. That's going to become incredibly relevant in just a few moments.
Really?
Prime numbers are really cool, and we're going to talk about them a lot today. So I think this is it's fortuitous. Fortuitous.
Fortuitous.
Fortuitous.
What a hard word.
I can't say that. It's like saying, I feel like I'm saying the word tortoise. Fortuitous. Okay, so a quick follow-up on last week's episode. We talked about hashing a lot. It's like a fundamental method of authentication. It's a one-way function that obscures information you put in, but it's repeatable. And so if I hash the word Zach on my computer and I hash the word Zach on your computer, regardless of the date and time, as long as I use the same algorithm and I don't salt it, which we also talked about, I'm going to get the same result. So that becomes really, really useful. And we're going to talk about that today, too. We at least have like 3 listeners now, which I think is great. That's a prime number. That's pretty
Well,
cool.
if you think about it, Ken, we've been just growing exponentially. I mean, first it was 1, 2, now 3. We've been growing at a rate of 100% every day, except for today, which would only be 50%.
Yeah, no, I think that is that's awesome. So we love all of our listeners.
Hey, Jed.
Hey, Tyler, what's up? It's just kind of it's kind of interesting. If the Fibonacci sequence continues, we will have 5 listeners at this time. I'm not sure I can handle my excitement.
Ooh, you know what's
So.
funny? I have actually an article pulled up right now, which relates to our topic, which also talks about the Fibonacci sequence. How quaint.
How quaint indeed. Okay, so. All right, so before we get started on this topic, this is a big topic. This is one of our fundamental building block topics, so we want to do a good job at this. But a couple disclaimers. Neither one of us are cryptographers. Neither one of us are mathematicians, so some of the stuff we talk about doesn't even make sense to us. And so we're probably not the best to explain it, but we're going to give it a good try. The third thing is cryptography is one of those things that it builds upon the work of others. And so, it's not something you want to like spin up a version of cryptography in an afternoon because you'll most likely get owned. They're valid, highly studied protocols and ciphers that you should use. And we're going to talk about a couple of them, but we highly recommend you study the research and follow best practices. And you won't have to worry about a lot of this. This stuff is not meant to be practical, it's more meant to be theoretical, and the topics here will help us in future discussions. So that's my disclaimer for the day.
Wow, very nice, Ken. Very nice. Now no one can get mad at us.
Somebody will definitely get mad at us. But
Nope,
it's just funny.
impossible.
So, okay, this is awesome. So cryptography has been around for like a really long time. It goes back thousands of years. There's been like simple ways of encoding messages. There's been more advanced ways as technology's progressed. It's required additional means to do so, and you know, when the internet launched, or when the internet like kind of exploded in the 90s, that's really where a lot of this cryptography that was available to, you know, civilians and not just the military really kind of took off. There was some research done before, but that was all pretty much theoretical. But now we have these amazing computers, and they can calculate like these huge sums, and we have to figure out a way to make those like generally one-way functions. So without, I can send you a message, and without knowing exactly how I did it and what key I used, it's not reversible. So that's pretty much the fundamental premise of cryptography. You know, back in years ago, you know, they dealt with things like basic ciphers, where they would do clever things like a simple substitution cipher, where he said, okay, I'm going to shift every letter 8 digits in the alphabet. So an A becomes a, you know, whatever, a G, or whatever the 8th letter is. I don't know. Stuff like that.
I remember being a kid and cutting out a circle, and it would have on the outer ring of the circle A through Z, and then just a ring just below it, it would have all the letters shifted by, you know, about 8 characters. And we would pass notes to each other all the time. If the teacher, I remember the teacher, my third grade teacher, Mrs. Jo Anderson, she caught one of our notes once. When she tried to read it, it came out as Grive Vidivord.
That's awesome.
And we were saying, yeah, it's just our secret code. She wouldn't bother.
Have you seen the movie The A Christmas Story?
Isn't that the movie that everyone quotes endlessly and it'll just never end?
Yeah, it's a Ralphie. Ralphie and his BB gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he sends away for his little orphan Annie Ovaltine decoder ring, right?
Oh.
And he waits in the message while his little brother has to go, or waits in the bathroom to decode his message while his little brother pounds on the door because he's got to go. And he sets his decoder ring to the preset setting, and then he decodes it, and the message is, be sure to drink your Ovaltine. He's very upset. That's a substitution cipher. So, if you were communicating from Rome to your troops that are, you know, vanquishing the Huns in Germania, you could use a substitution cipher and probably be okay. Now, with computers, we can do things like frequency analysis and break those pretty fast. So we've got to come up with more advanced techniques, and we're going to talk about a lot of them. Relevance here in the news. So Australia, in their infinite wisdom, thinks that they've been spouting off a whole bunch of crap about how commendable the laws of mathematics are, but in Australia, the laws of Australia govern not the laws of mathematics, and that is a load of crap. There's a guy, a dude named Turnbull. I don't know if he's like the prime minister or whatever. I don't know my Australian politics. Let's see here. And so he's determined that he's just going to break encryption by law, and that's going to be that. And so right now there's like some sort of tug of war. Obviously they can't do that for reasons that we're going to describe. So like Apple right now actually has people down there lobbying Turnbull, trying to convince them that, they're a bunch of idiots and they shouldn't do this. So we'll see how successful that is.
Wow.
You know, the sad part of this is like any sort of like prohibition, right? Is, you know, laws on encryption will take, encryption out of the law-abiding citizens and the people who just want to keep, you know, their steamy chats with grandma a secret from, you know, prying eyes. And whereas, like, you know, your real ne'er-do-well individuals, they're always going to have options to cryptography. There are known ciphers and systems that they can employ. All it takes is a little reading on Wikipedia, and the government cannot break it. But they'll do what they can. They'll stop you and me from using crypto. But, you know, a terrorist? Probably not, unless they're dumb. That's a really unfortunate thing. It seems like our last few shows have had like a political activism sort of thing. If you're so inclined, give your Congress critter a call and say, hey, leave my crypto alone. So, yeah. Way to go, Australia.
Good job, Australia. You really set a precedent.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Perhaps it's all the like snakes down there. Maybe they just live in fear. I don't know.
Well, you know, everything is poisonous down there. They probably looked at encryption and said, you know, well, that'll probably kill us too.
Mate. Okay, so let's get started with the nitty-gritty. Okay, so cryptography, there's a fundamental assumption, and that's including randomness. So we talked about, in last week's episode, we talked about one-time passcodes and how they're typically generated using a seed. And so, and it's, as you might recall, the one-time password, it falls into the what you have category. So you might have who you are, you might have what you know, and you might also have a two-factor system that includes what you have. And so on your phone, there's a six-digit code that's sent to you, and that's generated off of a seed. And so the seed you have, the seed the server has, and it's based upon these time, it's time sensitive, and so every 30 seconds or whatever, it runs a process based upon that seed and generates this six-digit number. Now, that by definition is not random, right? That's based upon a seed. And so if you and I have the same seed for our accounts, our one-time passcodes are going to be the same. So, that's, you know, that's fine for the context of one-time passwords, but it's not at all random. It turns out that humans are, like, really hard at, you know, determining randomness. So, like, you could try to be random, but generally, humans fall prey to patterns. And so they'll begin to see patterns, they'll begin to follow patterns. It's just not in our identity to come up with random numbers. And so we have to use other tools. Random.org is a great example of this. They use antennas that collect atmospheric noise to generate randomness.
Wow.
So it's something I've actually used quite a bit when I'm doing like statistical sampling. I'll have to go into random.org, and if I need 500 samples, if I need 500 you know, recipients for a test email, for example, I'll go in there and I'll select 500, I'll throw them into Excel and sort by it, and then I can select my tools that way. There's other random generators. A lot of them are pseudo-random generators, and they're functioned off of a seed. Now, there's good reasons for doing this. I took an R class in graduate school. R is a statistical data mining, you know, sort of program. And we used seed values there. It's really convenient because we could all have random values. We could all use the random feature. But because we specified a seed, we all had the exact same random features. Lack of randomness is a killer in cryptography. If they can guess how your keys are generated, then the whole point is moot. You might as well just give them the data. You know, funny story, like a lot of us know the story of the Enigma. The Enigma was the machine that was used to, encode, communications between the Nazi leadership and the U-boats that wreaked havoc on.
That's right. On Mr. Turing.
Right, right. And so if you saw that movie, I forget the name of the movie. What was the name of the movie?
The Numbers Game, I think.
Yeah, The Number Game, or yeah, something like that. That was a fantastic movie, by the way. I highly recommend it. And it talks about this principle. But the fundamental flaw behind the Enigma, well, there's a couple. So first, they captured one, which was documented in the documentary U-571.
No, it was The Imitation Game. Dang.
Imitation Game. No, you're right there. I think
sorry,
right.
Please continue.
No, it's all good. So, you know, the British or the Allies captured some of this information, so that gave them a head start. They were able to understand how the Enigma machine worked. Very complex, capable of many millions of different codes. Very unlikely the Allies were going to break it, especially given the codes changed every day, right? And so you had at most 24 hours to brute force this, and then it was, you know, a lost cause. You'd start over again at midnight. But the one of the tools they used to break that was there was a radio operator that would always start his communications in the same way. He wouldn't vary the beginning parts of those communications like he was trained to do. And so because that wasn't random, they were able to pick up and they were to use that little bits of information to eventually break that daily encryption and process those dispatches. Another tool they used was weather reports, right? So weather reports are very static. They're very scheduled. And so they often use the same keywords and the same structure. And so they're able to use that lack of randomness to gain advantage and vanquish the Nazis. So incredible. One of the, like, Alan Turing is one of the most fascinating individuals. He did as much to win the war as anyone. Highly recommend you research that a little bit. But as brilliant as he was, and how brilliant the machine was, there was no way he could do that without those slip-ups by the German military that was used, you know, to break their cryptography.
Wow. So it all comes down to human error, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like human errors are inevitable. And so we're going to talk about that a lot today. You know, a lot of these systems are perfect, but the people who run it are less so. Okay, so speaking of perfection, let's talk about a perfect cryptography method that cannot be broken. It is impossible to break it, and that's called the one-time pad.
Ooh, what is this? This is new.
So this is straight up like 007, the Americans, USSR, like legit stuff, okay? The one-time pad is just a pad of numbers, or a pad of characters, and it's used in like a substitution cipher, right? And so what it does is it's randomly generated, and then these signals are broadcast to like spies. So let's say you are a spy for the Soviets, and you know, I know you're communist leanings, Zach.
That's true.
And so you're here to spy on, you know, the man.
And yep, I worship Microsoft. So,
right,
yeah.
Right. And report things back to Chairman Gates.
Mm-hmm. No. It's Dear Leader Gates.
Dear Leader Gates. Yes. Okay. So, one thing you could do is they could ship you this one-time pad. It could contain several, many, many pages of just these random numbers, okay? Or random characters. And what they would do is they would send you messages in some means. It could be like you see it in all different kinds of movies. You could see it like in a personal ad in a newspaper. Or the creepiest one by far, have you heard of number stations?
Number stations?
Yes.
Can't say I have.
So number stations are freaky. They freak me out. If you go on YouTube, search for number stations, you can listen to them. And these are recordings.
Oh, number stations. Yeah, there's that famous one in Russia.
Right, and they play like the little jingles and stuff like that. It totally wigs me out. And they broadcast on regular schedules, and they'll just say a series of numbers. And these numbers, they don't really know what they're used for, but one of the prevailing theories, one I personally believe, is they're used to communicate to spies. Now, one of the cool things about it is that these radios just broadcast. They broadcast everywhere. And as long as you can hear that, if you can hear that signal, then you can receive those instructions anonymously, right? Listening is a undetectable, you know, event. And so I can listen to a number station, I can jot down my message, and I can decode them with a one-time pad. And that's a perfect method of secrecy. So it depends on a couple. So like these politicians, like this idiot in Australia who thinks that he's just going to pass a law to break encryption. Like, he needs to go to wikipedia.com or .org and type in one-time pad and realize how his scheme is going to fall apart. Not that he cares. This is far more about politics than it is about tech. But, like it's a flawed premise. Like, if they want to be unbreakable, it's unbreakable. A lot of times these number pads, they're kept in, like, their micro dots are kept in very small. They're often kept or printed on paper that can easily be eaten and dissolved. And the vulnerability of these one-time number pads is that if the key is captured, then it's all over, right? And all those messages can be decrypted. Furthermore, if you reuse the one-time pads, or if they're not random, if they're like pseudo-random, and we can predict, you know, what they'll be in the future, then that can be broken too. So there's a really famous instance called the Venona Project, right?
The Venona Project.
The Venona Project. So V-N-O-N-A.
Okay.
So the Venona Project was a bunch of Soviet spies. Well, okay. The Venona Project was actually a program started by the NSA to expose these Soviet spies, right? And so it took 37 years. And over that time, they obtained over 3,000 messages. And eventually resulted in some of these crazy things you hear about. So Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, like the two spies, the husband and wife that went to the electric chair in the 50s.
Yeah.
They were exposed through this Venona Project.
Whoa.
And so what actually the flaw was that they used... they made some like problem. They had problems in their one-time pads, and so.
What were those problems?
Well, they reused some of the keys. They reused entire pages. And it was still very hard to decrypt. But they made these fundamental flaws and duplicated this information, and that allowed the Allies to decrypt that, and ultimately resulted in arrests and executions of Soviet spies in the United States and the United Kingdom. So some of the stuff it's pretty crazy. Like, some of the stuff wasn't even declassified till 1995. It was
so crazy to think, like, this wasn't too long ago either.
No, this wasn't too long ago at all.
Like, not at all. I mean, yeah.
The advantage of a one-time pad. So, like, if you are a Soviet spy, and I'm trying to listen in on these communications to you, and I don't have your one-time pad, like, you ate it, you know, you chowed it down when I busted through the door, I can make that message say anything I want to say, right? I could, you know, your message could say cloak, and I could make it say puppy, or any other 5-character word. Right? And so, if it's done correctly, it is unbreakable encryption. So these idiots who think they can legislate encryption, there's a lost cause. Now, they have problems. So you can't reuse the key, right? And then you can't let the key be found, right? And so those are some of the two big problems. But the big one that really kills it, like for our purposes, is that you have to provide a mechanism of key exchange, right? So I have to give you, you and I need to have the same key, right? And so, like, if I were to mail it to you, like, someone could conceivably intercept that, right? Or it could get lost, or, you know, whatever. And so if you and I are on different physical locations, it becomes very difficult for that key exchange to happen. And so that that fundamental problem predicated a lot of advances in cryptography that came later, including the ones that's occurring right now as we have this conversation. So we're going to introduce a couple friends here. So typically when you talk about cryptography, you use the good guys, Alice and Bob, and then the evil guy, Charlie, right? ABC. And so Alice and Bob are always trying to communicate with each other, and Charlie's always trying to listen in. So you and I are going to be the good guys, so it's going to be Ken and Zach who are trying to talk to each other. And Chad, you know, the commie agent, he's going to be the one who is listening to us in our examples.
Oh, okay. So the usual
right.
Suspects.
The usual, right. So I want to talk about a couple forms of encryption that are really popular today. And the first one I'm going to talk about is AES. Advanced Encryption Standard. So this came out of a government project to select a new cipher. A cipher is just a means of encryption. And it was invented by a guy named Rindale, and that's like Danish, so I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right. I apologize. There's like a J in it, and I don't think there should be, but that's my American bias coming out. Randall, something like that. Anyway, so that was selected as the specification for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or commonly known as NIST, in 2001. Okay. There were a whole bunch of ciphers selected or chose or that were put up for consideration, but AES, the Rendell cipher, was the one that won. And so it's a complex cipher. I'm not gonna get in the math of it. But just it has three different key links. We're gonna talk about key links. It's 128 bit, 192 bit, and 256 bit. And let's see here if I can figure out.
When was this again? Remind me.
2001.
2001. Okay, so again, pretty recently.
Yeah, definitely. So previous to this, there was DES, right, or the Data Encryption Standard. I think that was invented by IBM. I might be wrong here, but and that was a 56-bit encryption, and that had a lot of problems. And interestingly enough, they invented there's a variation of that called triple DES. So DES is this deprecated system, right? It's old. It can be broken if an adversary has enough resources. But triple DES is actually what's used in your cards, your credit cards, in the chips there. So it's all done with triple DES, and that's
wait. The new chips, you mean? Not the magnetic strip.
Yeah, the chips themselves. So when you
because the strip only transmits just the card numbers on the card, right?
Right.
That's right.
And so, but the good news is, like, 256-bit AES, that's certified by the National Security Agency as suitable for encrypting top secret information. So it comes from the top.
Does that make you feel safe, Ken?
Well, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the NSA. They do some good. Like responsibilities is to ensure that the United States interests are protected through strong cryptography. But then they've also shown us some indications that they may not always be interested in that. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. But AES, get back on topic. AES is a symmetric encryption scheme, right? So what symmetric encryption means that both of us have to have a key. And so one way to think about this is that I send you a key in the mail, right? Or some other means. I give you a key at a cocktail party, and then you take it home, and I have a copy of the key, and you have a copy of the key, and then I want to send you secrets, and so I throw them into a locked box. And so I unlock the box with my key, I put the super secret stuff inside, and I lock the box with my key, and I ship it to you, and you take your key out, and you unlock it. And that's essentially how symmetric encryption works. It's all based upon the key. But again, it goes back to this problem we had with the one-time never pad. How do we protect these keys from being intercepted or lost or whatever, right? That's the fundamental problem. And so there are some ways to do this. Like a lot of times, and we employ similar things in the IT field, right? So I might email you a username and I might text you a password, right? It's two different pieces. They're on two different mediums. The chances of both being compromised or even like related to one another to have the necessary context to breach the system, it's unlikely, right? So that's a method of like key exchange, in a loose sense. But for the most part, AES is used for situations where keys exchange is not an issue, and that's either done through a mechanism for doing key exchange we're going to talk about in a minute. But or it's done in a method where the keys are just stored in your local machine. So BitLocker, for example, or File Vault on a Mac, that's all using AES encryption. Those keys are kept on the machine. They can be backed up, but for the most part, they're kept on the machine. And there's a mechanism to log into it and retrieve that key and then unencrypt your system.
Seems simple.
Yeah. So, but this key exchange problem, I mean, it's really an issue. And so when the internet came about, we started thinking about, so it's entirely possible for Ken and Zach to have never met, right? Like we're wow buddies or whatever, and we want to share some secret, super secret information, but we've never like seen each other before. So how do we do this? Well, that comes into the realm of asymmetric encryption. And this is really the fundamental building block of the internet. We talked a little about certs previously. Certs all use this concept of asymmetric encryption. So you might have heard of RSA or Diffie-Hellman. These are two key exchange public cryptography algorithms that are commonly used, right? And so I want to talk briefly about how they work. So public cryptography is based around the concept that there's actually two keys, okay? There's a public key, and the public key is something that is widely broadcast. So I can throw it up on my website. I can throw it up on these like directory of public keys. There's a great one called, what is the name of that? Keybase. So if you go to keybase.io/, well, I'm not going to give my username, but go to keybase.io. You can go on here and...
yeah, I'm kind of curious. Let's see.
And so if you go there and click on the right-hand side, there's a team thing. So my first link is like, or my first user is Chris Nojima. Nohima, I don't know how you say it. And if you click on his username, you can bring up his public keys, right? It's something that's widely broadcast. It's designed to do that.
Wow, that's interesting.
So there's a second key, though, and that's a private key, and that's something you have to hold very, very secret. You take every possible precaution to keep your private key secure. And these keys are linked, but they're linked in such a way that knowing one cannot be used to discover the other one. Right?
What?
So if I know your public key, there is no way that I can easily know your private key, right?
That's true. It's true.
They're linked, but they are, there's no way to calculate one from the other. And that becomes really important for reasons that, you know, we're going to talk about. So let's say I want to send you some information. So we could set up an AES encryption, right? I could send you a key, and then we could both have a key to open up this lockbox. But this is where the metaphor gets interesting. Instead of sending you a lockbox to which we both have keys, what happens is you send me a padlock that's unlocked. And I put my crap in a box, and I lock that padlock, and I send it back to you. And only you have the key to unlock it. And so what a public key does is it gives me the means to encrypt information in such a way that only you with that related private key can decrypt it. And so if you set up an account on Keybase, you're going to generate a private or public-private key pair. And so one is going to be very public and one is going to be super secret. And that is how asymmetric encryption works. So there's an interesting piece to this. You can actually do the inverse as well. So one thing I might do with you is I might first encrypt a piece of information. Let's say I'm going to send you like 10 dirty secrets about Chad, right?
Ho, 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 ho.
So,
hey, Chad. How you doing?
Yeah, he's doing good. Congratulations, Chad, by the way. I just want to say that. Congratulations. Today is a great day for him. That's all I'm going to say. Way to go, buddy. And
yeah, good job, Chad. I don't know what I'm cheering you for.
Yeah, but we're proud of you.
Yeah, good job, Chad.
So he... So if I'm going to send this like list of 10 secrets about Chad to you, one thing I might do is I might first encrypt it with my private key and then encrypt it with your public key and send it to you. Why would I do that?
No, Ken, why would you do that?
That's not a rhetorical question. The trick is this comes from this method of like verification, right? Or authentication. So with your public key out in the internet, anybody and their mother can send you encrypted messages, right?
Okay.
And so Chad could go on to your Keybase account, could take your private key, or excuse me, could take your public key, encrypt a message to you, and send it to you, and sign it dash Ken. Right? And there would be very, there would be no way to know if I actually sent that, or if it was a spoof by Chad trying to introduce some misinformation. Right? However, this is where it gets interesting. If I first sign that information with my private key, you can go, and then I sign it with your public key. What would happen when you receive that information is you would decrypt that with your private key, and there would still be a bunch of gibberish. It'd still be encrypted, right? But it would be encrypted with my public key, which you could easily access. And then you would know that two things happened. First, I encrypted it with your public key, which means you were able to decrypt it with your private key. And then I signed it by encrypting it with my private key, and then you decrypted it with my public key, and you knew that whoever sent that to you had to have access to my private key. It's a method of verifying that I am actually indeed the sender.
Wow.
So you have it cryptography, and then you also have authentication, and it's also called like non-deniability, right? Or non-repudiation, right? And so one thing I might want to do with this is I might, like, let's reverse this example. I'm going to send you, I might force you to send me a payment, for example, that's signed with your private key. So I can say, hey, this guy, there was no way that, you know, in case you claim that someone else did this on your behalf, there's no way this is possible because you signed this. You cryptographically signed this receipt with your private key. And so then I can, it does not allow you to say, oh, I never did that, right? And so that's a concept called non-repudiation. It's really important when you start dealing with these like transactions that are really common on the internet. So, yeah.
That's pretty cool. When was this method invented? Do you know how long has it been around?
So it was started in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and a lot of it was theoretical. A lot of it didn't really get applied until later. But it's a really interesting topic. So let's talk a little bit about how it works, okay? So the fundamental like assumption of this, and let's talk about RSA in particular. That's pretty common for key exchange. Oh, one other note. So symmetric and asymmetric encryption, they both have advantages and disadvantages. So symmetric is very strong and it's very fast. And so if we somehow establish this key between us, then we can encrypt information very quickly with very low like processor overhead. And we can do this very, very fast, right? And very, very secure. The big problem with that is, as we discussed, is that key distribution aspect. How do I share this key with you securely? So what typically happens is this asymmetric encryption, it is slower, the keys are a lot larger, and it's more expensive in a computer sense, right? It takes more operations to do this, and so it's not preferred. And so what I might do is I might set up an asymmetric encryption with you, and I might use that to share my symmetric key for like AES. And then from there on out, the only thing we use that asymmetric encryption for is the initial key exchange. And then after that, you and I just use the symmetric key. It's very fast, and then we can change that anytime we want. So if you connect to a website, it's going to do what's called a handshake. It's going to send some information to it using the website's public key. And then it exchanges a symmetric key, and then we're off to the races. Okay. So that's kind of the use case. We use asymmetric to set up the symmetric. If that makes sense.
No, it makes complete sense. Okay.
So
good explanation, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. It's you're welcome, Ken. Now the mechanics are you know somewhat more detailed, but this is a kind of a whole high level overview of what's happening. So let's talk a little bit about how RSA works. RSA is widely used. It's a very common public key public-private cryptography system. So RSA is focused, the fundamental problem of it, it's called the RSA problem, is it's hard to factor products of large prime numbers. Let me say that one more time. It's difficult to factor the product of two large prime numbers. So what's a prime number, Zach? I'm going to test
it. Oh, dear God. A prime number is a number in which Ken explains what a prime number is.
So a prime number is a number that cannot be, that can only be divided by one and itself. Right?
Yep.
So let's take a prime number such as 17, right? You can go do your exercises, right? But you can't divide it by 2. You can't divide it by 3. You can't divide it by anything except for 1. So 17 divided by 1 is 17. Or you can divide it by itself. So 17 divided by 17 is 1.
Yep.
And so, but if you, you contrast with like a non-prime number, so let's take, for example, the number 16. So 1 less. So we can divide that by 1. We can divide that by 16. We can divide that by 2. We can divide that by 4. And we can divide that by 8. And so it's a lot easier to factor a number like that. By definition, prime numbers have to be odd. Why is that? Because you can't divide them by 2.
Yep.
So, anyway, so these prime numbers, they're very, very large. Very, very large. Like, I mean, way bigger than anything you can imagine. But it turns out that if I multiply two of these huge prime numbers together, it is nearly impossible to factor them out. And so that becomes this RSA problem. Now, that gets kind of interesting. We have to use very, very, very large prime numbers to get this to work. Computers are fast. It's possible that a 760, it's been proven that a 768-bit RSA key, or RSA prime can be factored. Right? So they can calculate that this huge prime number times this huge prime number generates this key, or generates this RSA prime. But that's it's an incredibly hard problem. Now, advances in quantum computing, that's actually what people are scared about. Quantum computing can potentially try multiple solutions at the same time, and it can break RSA, and so they're pretty concerned about that. There is some speculation that the NSA can break a 1024-bit RSA encryption.
You're kidding me. Really?
The way they do it is they can, and again, I am not a mathematician. Let's see here.
Wow. I don't know if that's a testament to how big of a problem RSA has with prime numbers, or if that's a testament to how powerful the NSA has become when it comes to decryption.
So, let's see here. Let me see if I can find this. So basically the way it works is they're able to split it up into 4 steps. And so there's some speculation that the NSA has done all the work on the first 3 steps of the factorization process. And so for any given 1024-bit key, it's that final step that becomes an issue. And they are able to do so they have 3/4 of it already done, and so they can quickly do the last step. I can't find the article that I had to talk about. Let's see here if I can find it. Anyway, so they estimated that it would cost $100 million to break a 1024-bit key. And for our government, that's like, you know, probably nothing. So
how long would it take them to do it?
I'm trying to look at that date.
Well, not like when they started doing it, but like when... how long would it take them conceivably to break a 1024-bit RSA encryption.
Yeah, so...
Like, how long would that take? Would that take, like, days for them?
I'm not sure they know. This is... it's concerning because this is just a theoretical attack at the moment, but it could be employed, and it's most likely being employed. Now, some of the Edward Snowden leaks that happened indicated that NSA was working towards, had already or had already achieved this capability. But it's just, you know, it's just, but we don't know. We should assume that 1024-bit keys are broken. And so,
wow, holy
crap.
The
nice thing about encryption is that we can just double that, right? And so we can go to 2024 or 2048-bit keys, and that becomes infinitely more complicated to do so. So it's very unlikely that a 2048-bit key or a 4096-bit key can be broken, right? The encryption is just too strong.
It's all about length, not about complexity. That's what we talked about the last episode, which we highly recommend you listen to.
Yes. So,
still looking around.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Zach.
No, actually, you know what? You go ahead. I was only going to mention something about just kind of reinforcing the idea of length, because it's always length. It's never complexity, but. You know, we kind of already touched on that, yada, yada, yada. But please.
No, I think you're exactly right. Okay, so let's just primes are going to quantum computing is eventually going to break RSA factory and primes. It's just a matter of until they get these quantum computers with enough qubits to be able to break them. Okay. There is a relatively newer form of cryptography called elliptic curve cryptography, and that follows a similar pattern, and the math on this gets a little wild. But basically, there's these fundamental mathematical problems that are really difficult to solve, right? And so, let me just read you the definition here. It is assumed that finding the discrete logarithm of a random elliptic curve element with respect to a publicly known base point is infeasible. Okay, so what that means, I don't know, right?
I was about to ask for the English translation.
Yeah, it's a mathematical problem that's really hard to solve, right? An elliptic curve is a plane curve over a finite field, which consists of the point satisfying the equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. So, that is beyond my mathematical capability. And so we don't need to go too much further into it. Now, elliptic curves, it's a much harder problem, and it actually just lets us use smaller keys, right? So... there's a 3072-bit RSA public key is equivalent to a 256-bit elliptic curve public key.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Now, so that's all great. The hard part of that, this discussion, though, is, you know, the fundamental assumption we make with RSA is that factoring two large prime numbers is difficult, right? And we know that with quantum computing, it's not, or not nearly as. But with elliptic curve, we still have the same problem. Is finding these solutions to these elliptic curve problems, is that a difficult enough problem to, you know, warrant using our, using for our encryption? Now, the NSA says it can use protected, it can protect information classified up to top secret with 384-bit keys. So that's a good sign, but there's also some indication that the NSA has some information that it may not share about elliptic curves, and it may have some ability to reduce the work factor to break elliptic curve key, and You know, one thing you have to look at with NSA, and this again comes out of the Snowden leaks, is they put a lot of effort into influencing standards bodies into choosing certain technologies. And that makes me put my tinfoil hat on a little tighter. And so,
as always,
there has been evidence of them like trying to influence algorithms that are used to generate like cryptographically random numbers. And there's also evidence of them trying to manipulate certain parts of cryptography algorithms. And so the fact that they're backing elliptic curve, it's a good thing, but it's also possibly a troubling thing. And so, you know, it's entirely possible the NSA is saying, okay, we can use this because we think we're the only ones with the resources to break this problem. And so, I don't know, a lot of experts in the post-Snowden world, they believe you should use really long RSA keys and just call it a day. Like, it's very unlikely that they can break, you know, a 4,096-bit RSA key. But, you know, we don't know, and that becomes the problem. It's all about uncertainty. Now, the truth of the matter is given infinite time and given infinite resources, any key can be broken. The question then becomes, like, so what? If, you know, this conversation, we weren't recording it and releasing it to the internet, and it was supposed to be some big secret, and it took them 10,000 years to decrypt it, well, you and I aren't going to care much. The problem is if it gets down to a short enough scenario where we might. And so cryptography always needs to stay ahead of the curve. Now, the good news is, as we talked about, increasing, doubling the key length provides an infinite increase in security. So if they can break 4,096-bit keys, you know, they can, they're probably not going to be able to break, you know, 8,192-bit keys anytime soon. And so we just need to, you know, always keep ahead of that and, you know, see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing to keep in mind and keep aware of, which is kind of half of what we usually talk about here on this podcast. It's keeping a good mind of the world around you and what's going on. I mean, for the longest time, a 6-character password is about the best you needed, and now it's like anything less than 20, I wouldn't recommend.
Right.
The greatest print in the world, Ken. I know.
No, I think you're exactly right. Well put. Okay, so let's talk briefly upon implementation. So a lot of these technologies, like, we use on a daily basis. So if you connect to a website that's encrypted with TLS, or you encrypt to any of these secure services, they're all going to use bits and pieces of this technology. On your local laptop, you have Windows, you know, you can have BitLocker, that's going to use AES. You can have File Vault on a Mac, that's going to use AES. You can encrypt disk images or zip files or you know, other file compression or encryption tools. They're all typically going to use some form private or of symmetric or asymmetric encryption to do so. So it's something that we don't have to think a lot about. It's built into our systems. These algorithms are widely published and reviewed. And good cryptography is based upon the concept that you can give everybody as much information about the algorithm as possible. It all comes down to the key strength and the randomness and security of the key. And so just because you know how an encryption scheme works doesn't give you any advantage. And so that's why we use these encryption methods that are widely reviewed and widely understood, and we let people hammer on them, you know, for years and years and years, and we look for vulnerabilities, and we're always trying to keep apprised of where it's at. One point I want to talk about briefly is this concept of key management. So this isn't something the average user has to worry about, but if you get a little bit nerdy, it becomes a factor. So right now, you know, my laptop is encrypted. If I were to lose that password and I were to lose the recovery key they give you, that laptop is done. That information on the laptop is irretrievable. So it's important to have a mechanism to keep those keys safe. It's actually a risk to enterprises. So, you know, I work at a company that has a huge database, and if we were to lose the encryption key to that, we would be screwed. And there's no way to recover it. That's what makes it so strong. And so one of the things that hampers encryption, you know, at least on the consumer end, is this concept of, you know, customer service. And what happens if, you know, somebody says, oh, yeah, give me all this encryption. And then 2 days later, it has to do a password reset. Uh-oh. That doesn't work.
Nope.
So there's all these tools you can use. There's a lot of key management tools you can use. A lot of times people use encryption on your behalf. So like Dropbox, for example, if you have files on there, they're technically encrypted with Dropbox's encryption key. The problem becomes, though, is that it's Dropbox's encryption key, and so anybody in there with a warrant can get access to that information. Tools such as Backblaze, an online backup system that I highly recommend, they start out with that basic concept. They encrypt with their own key, and so your information is protected from the outside. But if you're worried about Backblaze employees having the capability to decrypt your data, you can provide your own private key, but then they tell you like four times that, look, if you lose this, you're screwed, right? It's all over.
Yeah.
And so you have to take some of the responsibility on yourself. But there's some risk there involved. Encryption has a downside. It can slow down your performance as you're performing an additional operation on every piece of information. And you lose that key, you're done.
At least in the case of Backblaze.
Don't type in Blackbase. They had to actually buy that domain because so many people were typing it in. It's actually a cool story. It was not a site for children, as they say.
That's amazing. Oh, yeah. Man. All I was going to say was, anyway, I mean, the worst case with a Backblaze is if you lose that key, you just lose your backup, so you just
start over,
to do it again.
Right?
You just start over. That's essentially it. But that's not always the case, especially when you talked about, you know, if that laptop you were talking about earlier, if you lost the key to that, I mean, yeah. Sorry, game over, man, game over.
Yeah, and I have encrypted backups, and, you know, if I lost all my keys, it'd be a bad day. So,
just a little bit.
Yeah, not great. You know, one of the important things to think about is that, you know, attacks that are going to happen on cryptography or on encrypted systems, they're typically not going to hit the encryption itself. It's just too strong. It's kind of like trying to, you know, break into a bank, right? If you start hammering at the front vault, you're going to be there a while. But there might be another tool. That there might be another way in that's easier, right? And so they're going to look for things. They're going to look at, like, you know, the password you have written down in your monitor on a sticky note. Or they're going to look at, there's advanced tools where they can actually, like, take a running computer that's been decrypted and that has the key in memory, and they can freeze your RAM slots or your RAM with like liquid nitrogen and bring it down to such a point that memory is no longer volatile, and then they can put it into another PC and then retrieve the keys.
You're absolutely kidding me.
That's actually possible.
Oh my god.
They can also exploit a lack of randomness, as we talked about. And then probably the biggest vulnerability whatsoever is the user, right? You can install a keylogger on someone's PC. You know, you can hack their Facebook account and figure out their password there. For most people, it's probably the password on their, you know, super secret workstation. That's just a human flaw. Or, you know, you can, you know, resort to nefarious things. You know, one of the topics that it's a great exit KCD comic about cryptanalysis. You know, the easiest way to, you know, instead of somebody's laptop's encrypted, you know, 256-bit AES, you know, yeah, you can, like, set up a cluster and run attacks on that for, you know, a couple million years and maybe crack it. Alternatively, you can beat him with a $5 wrench until he gives you the password. And so, you know, again, that's the human vulnerability is coming to play. And so, you know, one thing to think about is what are your humans capable of, and are they able to maintain security?
Which is why, Ken, we're going to get to a point where we realize personal security, when it comes to the digital age, won't really come down to what kind of encryption you use. It'll come down to what gun do you carry.
Well, that could be, you know, that could be. You're only as good as you know,
$5 wrench.
Yeah, yeah. Right, and like, yeah, you might be able to hold up to it for a while, but you know, they can break you. Or you know, in the case of like the government, right, they can throw you in prison for contempt for not handing over your encryption keys, and you can choose how many months you want to spend in jail. And that happens. That happens frequently.
And you will break. They all do.
Yeah, and it comes down to a Fifth Amendment issue. You know, a lot of people have this discussion, right? Is it a violation, or is it a violation of your Fifth Amendment rights to be compelled to give a password? And I would argue it is. You know, people compare it to a safe, right? Well, a safe can be opened, right? A safe, you can take a torch to it and open it up and see everything that's in it. Encryption is really not need. Encryption is a different thing. Encryption, you have access to all the data, you just can't understand it. You can read every single bit on that disk. You just can't understand it. And so, you know, I think if I had a journal in a language that I came up with and nobody else could read, I think they would have a hard time forcing me to interpret it for them. But that's exactly what they're asking me to do. What they're asking somebody to do to when they're compelling them to give them your encryption key. And so I think it's a slippery slope. It's been there for a while. One tool we can touch on briefly is the concept of plausible deniability. Some encryption schemes have this. So TrueCrypt was a very popular free encryption tool. It shut down under mysterious circumstances several years ago. I really don't know what the story is. Maybe it's nothing. I don't know. I find that hard to believe. There's an offshoot of that called VeraCrypt, VeraCrypt. And that takes a lot of the work that the TrueCrypt developers had done. This has support for hidden volumes. So you could encrypt a disk with two passwords. And so one could be, you know, your super secret one where you, you know, where you keep like all your nefarious plans. And then you could have the other password be the one where you actually stored, you know, your cat photos, right? And so like if you were ever compelled to give that, give access to your credentials, you could give them the access to your non-incriminating part of that disk image, and there would be no way for them to determine if that's you know, if that's there. Now there's a downside to that too, and a lot of people actually are bothered by the fact this exists, because it basically says, hey, like, you can give them a key, and let's say you only have one key, right? You're not using plausible deniability. Well, they may beat you with that wrench until they're convinced that you actually only have one key. And so there's like a downside to that. I think it's a good thing to have. You know, I don't do anything, you know, bad. I'm not a, you know, nefarious person, but you know, these concepts, you have to consider it. You know, sure, look what's happened at the border right now and the sort of Gestapo tactics that the TSA is taking. You know, I have a serious issue with that from a moral, security, and privacy perspective. And so, you know, if I were flying overseas, I would certainly not be willing to give her my passcode. I'd probably resort to wiping my phone after I landed, just to get through immigration.
Wow.
And, you know, these things you have to think about, right?
Do you think this kind of stuff's going to change anytime soon?
Well, I think it's going to get worse.
Really?
Yeah,
how worse?
I do.
How worse do you think it could get?
Well, I think there's two things that are going to happen. So one is that they're going to successfully like lobby to have encryption, you know, largely neutered and reduced in effectiveness. So one thing they could do is they could force Apple to, you know, Apple's argument is like, hey, you know, this dude's a phone. Like, we can't help you if we wanted to. Like, we don't know it. We don't have access to his keys. We don't have access to his data. We don't know anything, right?
Yep.
And so NSA is like, well, come up with a system to help us, like, you know, type in the passcode 10,000 times until I get it. And Apple fought that, you know, with the case of that San Bernardino, you know, terrorist.
Yep.
Now, it's hard to feel sorry for a terrorist, but, I mean, it was a bigger point. And so
you think Apple did the right thing, right?
I do think Apple did the right thing. But the bigger issue, and I think they did what they had to do, right? Like, look, dude, we're not going to help you crack our software. That's unsafe. Especially given, like, the NSA exploits that have leaked in recent months, right? It's not like they have, you know, ironclad hold on all their stuff. But the thing is, and so what's concerning to me, though, is that, you know, you're going to get a situation, you know, some terrible event is going to occur, and it's going to be the impetus for Congress passing a law that says, you know, this zero-knowledge encryption that you're using on people's iPhones, it can't last anymore. You are forced to put, you know, to manage that keys so we can gain access to it. And I think that's what Australia is ultimately going for. They want a system where Apple knows what your key is so they can give it to the law enforcement when they're asked. You know, and if that doesn't happen, I think you're going to see some pretty draconian tactics taken to gain access to it. You'll see additional hacking by NSA. It's already going on. Let's not be foolish, or let's not be, you know, in denial. NSA is not always our friend when it comes to security. They're interested in creating exploits, not helping us solve them. And they're going to be draconian tactics to get people to reveal their private keys.
Sometimes, Ken, sometimes I think that that tin hat is a little too tight, and then sometimes I feel you're right on the money, and then sometimes I just can't tell.
Well, yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope that they can come to cooler heads. You know, cooler heads will prevail. But the fundamental fact is the math is real. Like, and unless there's something we don't know, like, I think that something encrypted with 4,096-bit RSA, I think that's pretty safe. I really do. And so they're going to have to figure out some other mechanism of getting it if they can't find the passcode, or if they can't find the key. So
just as an aside question, do you think that 4,096 will become unsafe within our lifetimes?
Yeah, it's possible. It really depends upon how much. I mean, it's not going to be done through, like, you know, computing as we know it today. But if quantum computing is able to advance to such a point where it's possible, yeah, it's definitely something to consider. Now, the nice thing about it, though, is the key length's arbitrary, right? We can just keep extending those keys. And, I don't think they're going to, I don't think they can win. And so,
no, all I have to do is just double that number and then.
Right.
You've already added it. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't think they're going to be able to win, but that's what scares me, because the only tool they have left is laws and law enforcement and dudes holding guns making you give them your keys. And, you know, I hope it doesn't come to that, but it's entirely possible that it will. So, you know, just to wrap up, encryption is incredibly crucial to everything we have, to everything we do on the internet, everything we do, you know, on our computers. It's in things you wouldn't think about. It's used to maintain security. It's also maintained to ensure that you're actually talking to people you think you are. You know, we not only want to keep information away from Chad, we also want to keep Chad from impersonating one of us in our super secret communications.
Freaking Chad.
And so that becomes, you know, that becomes an issue. Certain everything from Facebook to, you know, your OS. It's the fundamental building block of, like, online shopping. And, you know, it keeps our secrets safe. So, I hope this was helpful. I hope this provided a little bit of context, what actually happens when you have to type in your password to get into, you know, a website. Or, you know, what happens when you actually navigate to a website and it sets up that secure connection. I hope it gives you a little bit of things to think about. And I hope it leaves you a little bit more informed, you know, when the government's trying to do this crazy stuff and this guy in Australia is spouting his mouth off. You know, it's not as simple as he thinks. So
Nope, not even slightly. Well, Ken, do you have any parting words before we end our podcast for today?
Yeah, you know, don't do evil things, but also don't let your privacy be taken for granted. It's something that we're all entitled to. And the good news is that math and technology is on our side for the moment. And so we just need to aim and keep it that way.
Rock on. Okay, works for me.
Thanks, Zach.
Ken, thank you. A pleasure as always. Do we have a sneak peek on what next week's subject is going to be?
I'm not sure yet. We'll have to think. We'll have to talk about that. It's going to be something titillating for sure.
When do you think we'll be? When do you think we'll be at the end of our building block series?
You know, I think it's time for an application episode. So let's give that a spin.
Okay, sounds good. Ken, pleasure as always. We will see you next week.
Yep, see you next week, Zach. Bye.